The question was asked, what are the limits of halacha's change? What ability do rabbis have with changing halacha? And I want to combine that with the question that was asked about halacha in modern times, halacha's changing, halacha's ability to change. And let's begin with a general understanding of halacha and halacha's evolvement, and then we'll try to get to the answers to these questions. We discussed that in our parsha, we see that the Torah is eternal. The Torah doesn't change. So if the Torah tells us we can't eat meat with milk, the same way that was true 2,000 years ago, it's true today. It says in our parsha, these are the mitzvahs that we're obligated to watch for all generations to come. And that doesn't change. So everything we are going to discuss now has to be understood with that introduction, that the laws of the Torah are the laws of the Torah. You guys want to ask something on that?
But it doesn't actually say that, does it? It says you can't eat a calf in its mother's milk. That means if you have a calf from Argentina.
Okay, so that's what we're going to get to in a second. Jeff, you wanted something on that point?
Oh, no.
Okay.
Jeff asked a question.
What about the laws of like loans during Shmita year? That's changed.
So that's a specific question. If it's not answered by the end of trying to answer this question, so bring it up, okay? Let's just first get the general picture, and I think we'll also deal with that. Now, we just said that the laws of the Torah are the laws of the Torah, and they are eternal. We could answer this question on a simple level, but I think being that you guys are all old, and you're not 15-year-olds or 13-year-olds, so you could understand a much deeper understanding. I'm not coming to make your life easy. I could make things black and white, and then you would walk out of this classroom with a very black and white approach to what's going on. And I feel like it's only fair to you to address the gray as well. So now I'm going to confuse a little bit the boundaries of what I just said, that the laws of the Torah don't change. And I just want to have one request. Ordinarily, you know that in my classes, from my perspective, you could come when you want and leave when you want. I don't know what the Machon says, what Rav Lisman says, but from my perspective, I don't take it personally whenever you come, whenever you leave. That's as far as the Machon goes. That's not me. Whatever the Machon says, so you have to listen to the Machon. That's not me. From my perspective, I don't take it badly if a person walks in late, walks out early. I really don't care. I care for your benefit. But there are certain questions that are raised that sometimes I feel like I could only address them if you give me your word that no one's going to walk out in the middle. The answer is going to be a long answer, but I feel like I'm going to raise certain questions and maybe take away some things that you took for granted until now in your understanding of the religion, and if you won't be here and focused and hear me out to the end, you can walk out confused and I won't have the time to straighten things out. So I'm going to confuse you now, I'm telling you that, but you have to give me your word. Whoever's going to be here from this point on is giving me his word by the mere fact that he's here, that he's going to be here till then, till the end of this, the answer to this, which is going to take about a half hour. Okay.
How is this topic? What's the question we have?
So the question was, how much can and does halacha change? And the question was, so maybe wait outside and listen to the whole recording. Nah, stay. But then make it up if you have to leave. So we began by explaining that the laws of the Torah are eternal. And we discussed in our introduction to halacha Friday, 2 weeks ago, that together with the laws of the Torah that were given, was given a whole series of laws of Torah Shebal Peh, laws of halacha Moshe Mesinai that are passed down in tradition from Moshe, and a series of laws of logic from which we can derive the laws of the Torah for new questions. Now, that means that was given at Sinai. We were given the Yud Gimel Midot, 13 principles of logic, 13 laws of inference which God taught Moshe how to use, and we discussed that in order for a person to be able to apply them and use them, a person must A, have a tradition learned by a rabbi and have a good tradition, B, be pure in his approach to the Torah. A person has to remove himself of any biases. We said, you missed an introduction, that if you're going to be here for this, you can't walk out from now on. I'm just saying you weren't here for that introduction, so I have no problem. It's just so we said that Moshe Rabbeinu was given laws of inference, and these laws can only be applied by someone who has learned the Torah and learned it fully with a tradition. And leave one for Michael Makovi, he still might be coming. It's only fair. And you could make an alamechia if you will make an. Did you have in mind you would eat another slice of pizza? You thought you might potentially. So then don't make another alamechia. We're given the written law, we're given the oral law, and we're also given potential for expanding the written law with 13 principles that the 13 laws of inference. And those laws can only be applied by someone who has gotten the tradition, has gotten smicha, has learned very, very well by the rabbis, and he has reached that level where he could use them, where he could apply them, and when he applies them, he does it with pure, pure logic. Now the confusion begins. What happens when the rabbis use these laws of inference and derive a law from the Torah? That law is the oraisa. That law is biblical. Now that means that the written law has potential for expansion, because we were given laws of derivation, laws of logic, from which we could, using them with our tradition, we can expand the laws of the Torah. That means that if a new case arises that hasn't yet been judged, the judges can decide that by biblical law, the law is X, Y, or Z. And the Torah built this clause into the Torah. As we see, there is a special sacrifice that's brought called the Par Helam Dover. And that sacrifice, the Torah says, if the high court is asked a question about a law in the Torah, they are asked, is one permitted to do the following thing before an idol? Can one, for example, go to the bathroom before the idol of Baal Peor? And they analyze it and they decide for whatever reason that one may do so. And then Jews start following their ruling. Or let's say a different example. When we cut up an animal, so there are different fats in the animal. Some of the fats are permitted to be eaten, and some of the fats are biblically forbidden to be eaten. And if one eats them, he gets kares. He's told that he will be permanently cut off from him and his offspring. They'll die young, and they'll be cut off in the world to come. The Torah says one has to be very careful not to eat those fats. And that's why when we eat kosher, we're not only eating animals that were shechted, that were put to death properly halachically, but also animals that they took out the fats that were forbidden to be eaten. That's called trebering. That's what it used to be called in Europe. They kosher the animal. We salt the animal, we take out the blood, etc. There's a whole process. What happens if the court rules and the court says, this fat you may eat? And everyone starts eating that fat. And then 3 months down the road, the court analyzes it again. They use their laws of inference again, and they decide, hey, we messed up, we made a mistake. And the court sends out letters throughout the land and says, we made a mistake, you may not eat that fat. So now, the court has made a mistake in a ruling that is biblical. What do we see? Firstly, the Torah takes into account that a court can make a mistake. That's a mitzvah in the Torah. The Torah says, what happens when that occurs? On a biblical law, says the Torah, then this high court has a special sacrifice that they bring. They are responsible for the error that the Jewish people erred, and they have to bring a sacrifice. It's their responsibility. So we see that on a biblical law, it is feasible that the high court will have to rule and will use the laws of inference and will rule one way and then later overturn their own ruling and decide that they made a mistake earlier on. You guys with me till here?
Mm-hmm.
So this, first of all, the question was asked, can a court, one court overrule another court? So we've already seen that a court can overrule its own ruling. And the Torah says so. That's built in, that's a built-in clause, that's a built-in law in the Torah.
This is the Sanhedrin.
This is the Sanhedrin, the High Court. Now, someone asking something?
Wait,
we'll get this. Wait.
Yeah. The Sanhedrin has somewhat been reestablished.
That's a separate question. Wait. Let's continue with this. Let's get what we're talking about, and then later we'll deal with the extensions of it. So the High Court is, after purifying themselves and having a good tradition and learning the laws and learning the laws of logic and having a tradition on how to apply these laws of logic, they too can rule one way and then decide that really the ruling should be another way. Now, a court can disagree with another court. They should argue it out and come to a conclusion. What happens if the court lived 200 years ago and they ruled one way? Well, then a future court can overrule what that court ruled. For example, during the time of the first temple, the process of libation, nisuch, libation on the temple, on the altar, was done in one way. Came the rabbis in the period of the second temple, and they ruled differently. They said the libation has to be done differently. And basically they were saying, from this point on, in the time of the second temple, libation is going to be done this way, and this is what the Torah wants us to do. And they overruled the ruling that had been throughout the period of the first temple. So you had a change in halacha.
Was it the first time?
It's not the first time we have a disagreement. We see that when the question arose, can David marry into the Jewish people? Is David a kosher Jew or not? So some of the rabbis said, well, his great-grandmother was Ruth, Rosa Moabia, she's a Moabite. Another rabbi said, what do you mean? Only the male Moabites are forbidden from marrying into the Jewish people. So they argued it out, and finally they came to the conclusion that females are allowed to marry in. David is fit to be a Jew, and he's fit to marry into the Jewish people. Yeah?
Isn't the point relevant because Ruth's descendant was Jesse and not King David's mother?
That's a good question. Let's leave that for now. No, but we're dealing with one question. We can't deal with all the offshoots. If you want, later.
Where's the notebook?
So that's the point which I didn't want you to leave after we raise this. So now we've seen a few things that can be really confusing. We've seen that the High Court can expand the written law. We've seen that the High Court can err in expanding the written law. And we've seen that the High Court can correct it. We'll give one more illustration of this concept. The Jews were under King David, and then they were under his son, King Solomon, Shlomo. And Shlomo sinned, and he was told that in the time of his son, Rehavam, the kingdom would be split. And 10 of the tribes would be under someone else. They became under a man by the name Yeravam. And here we have the divide where we have the 10 tribes under Yeravam ben Nevat, and the 2 tribes, Yehuda and Binyamin, are under Rehavam, the son of Shlomo. When Yeravam becomes king, he is concerned that the Jews will go up to on the 3 regalim, we have the 3 holidays, Sukkot, Pesach, and Shavuos. And he's concerned that when they want to go bring the special sacrifices that they're supposed to bring, when they'll be Ole Regel, well, the temple was in the portion of Rehavam. So Rehavam will tell him, you want to come to the temple that's in my portion, you have to be my men. You can't be faithful to Yeravam and come serve God in my territory. That doesn't work. So Yeravam said, I have to get these Jews away from serving God in the temple. What did Yeravam do? Yeravam sat and learned. He was a big Talmud Chacham Yeravam. He was chosen to be the first king over the 10 tribes. He was chosen because he was a big Talmud Chacham and a big tzaddik. But he was more concerned with his own pride than with God. And therefore Yeravam sat and learned the Torah and learned. And then he came to the rabbis. And he came to the high court that was in his territory. And he said, I've just discovered something. I've just discovered that we made a mistake in our calculations of the year. We have to add a month here. And what he did was, by using derivations from the Torah, he was able to convince the high court, mistakenly, that they have to change the calendar. And by changing the Jewish calendar, he got the Jews in his territory to be observing the holidays at a different time than the Jews were observing the holidays in Yehuda. And slowly he led them to idol worship. Now, if Yeravim would have walked into the high court and said, "I want the Jewish people to serve idols," they would have killed him. He knew that. But Yeravim was a big Talmud Chacham. And Yeravim sat and learned the Torah and used the tradition that he had and the understanding that he had to mislead the Jewish people. What we see from Yeravim is that potentially the reason why is because Yeravim wanted to ensure he'd have his kingdom. Yeravim wanted to make sure that the Jews don't leave him. So he said the way to do it is to get them to serve idols. If they'll serve idols, they'll be under me. If they'll serve God, then they'll keep going to Jerusalem, which is out of my territory. That's in the Judean territory under Rechavim. We have two kingdoms in the land of Israel. The northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. The southern kingdom is under the rule of Rechavim. And that's where the temple is. Yeravim is concerned that if the Jews keep going to the south, they'll ultimately say, well, if he has the temple in his territory, he's the rightful king, not you. The split, let's leave that. We'll get there. We're almost there. In a few weeks in our Tanakh class. Come Sunday night. So, Yeravim gets the Jews to serve idols and he overturns the whole Jewish calendar. He messes it up for the 10 tribes, and this way the Jews in the north aren't really following when the real holidays should be. What we see from Yeravim is that potentially the courts could have come to that conclusion. The courts during that period, if not for the fact that Yeravim was deceitful, not for the fact that he was really tricking them, there was potential for the halacha to change so drastically biblically that every Jewish holiday would be on a different day. You guys with me? Mm-hmm. Now this shows us that the potential for change, even in laws of the Torah, used to be amazing. But you can't overturn the Torah. You could take the laws of inference and the laws of logic that the Torah gives us, apply them purely, truthfully, and then reach whatever conclusion you do. Yeravim used them deceitfully. But had Yeravim been honest, then the high court was with him. Even when he was deceitful, the high court was with him. So we see that the potential is there, using the laws of derivation, the laws of the 13 laws of logic, the potential is there for even changing our understanding of the Torah. You guys with me so far? Now this is something that if you quote outside this classroom, people will get very upset at you. What's the trouble with that? One second. Nothing's a big deal. What? It sounds logical to you? I think it is logical. I'm not making up what I'm saying. I'm quoting two things. Yeah. One second. What's wrong?
In the case of Yeravim, of the many instances of people who are both Talmud Chachamim and Rashi's at the same time.
I think that one is many, and there was more than one. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you wanted something?
Can you repeat that, the last part? That
We see from Yeravim that by using the laws of derivation, the Sanhedrin, the fact that Yeravim made such an extreme request, the fact that Yeravim's demand was to change the whole calendar and make every Jewish holiday fall out on a different day, because he had a month, so then instead of Rosh Hashanah being now, it's a month off. So that didn't bother anyone. The fact that Yeravim said something so extreme, that wasn't bothersome. They said he has good proofs from the sources, and using the laws of logic, they analyzed it, and he was able to deceive them all into believing that that was really the way to understand the Torah. So the fact that until that generation, the understanding of the Torah was one way, and now Yeravim was coming to make it another way, that didn't bother the Sanhedrin. That was permitted. He was deceitful. He wanted really to trick them, and he succeeded in tricking them. That was the problem. But the fact that we were going to change our understanding of the Torah so drastically, that the Sanhedrin was willing to accept. Yeah?
You're saying people outside will have trouble with this. Why?
So let's leave that. That's not important for now.
No, you're saying this is about
people like things being black and white. People are used to saying whatever it says in Torah, it's what we do, it's what my father did, that's what my grandfather did. And there's truth to that. We'll get to that. You start telling people that once upon a time the world was a little different and there was more potential for change, people have a hard time swallowing it. Then it's not black and white anymore. That's why I said, I'm going to introduce you to the areas of gray which most people can't handle. I'm assuming you guys can and should handle. Yeah.
Is it really such a fundamental change? It can't change.
Yeah.
Okay, although he did, does that really...
Think about it. On Yom Kippur, they weren't fasting. They were doing malach on Yom Kippur. Rosh Hashanah, they weren't celebrating. They were celebrating Rosh Hashanah a month old. No, he did it forever.
Well, he kept doing it every year. He kept saying
correct?
It was a month wrong.
He got the whole 10 tribes off.
Every year.
Yeah.
You had a month. That's you had a month for the rest of your life, eternity.
It's enough to add 1 month and everything's off. Next. So now let's make sense of what's going on here. We said that the earliest generations could apply this. And they did. They applied it in the time of the first Beis HaMikdash, and they applied it in the time of the second Beis HaMikdash. Now what happened as time went on was that our sages recognized that the tradition had worn down. And their grasp and deep understanding of the 13 principles was not as good as the previous generations. And therefore, they limited themselves. They said, we can no longer analyze the Torah and come to true conclusions using these laws of derivation because our ability to apply this tradition has gone down. Our understanding of this tradition has gone down and we can't do it. So our sages said that no rabbi could come in the time of the Talmud already. They said no rabbi could come and say this is the ruling and this is the source and invent his own source. We no longer can answer questions by looking at the Torah and taking the 13 laws of derivation and saying this is the answer from the Torah. One must have a tradition. What did the previous rabbis say? What does it say in the Mishnah? I could learn from the Mishnah. I could apply what it says in the Mishnah. But I cannot overturn what previous generations said. The rabbis of the Talmud already recognized that they can't apply the laws of logic as correctly as previous generations had. They said our tradition is worn down. We can't do it. So now we start seeing the minimization of the powers of the Sanhedrin with regard to the Doraisa, to the Torah law. From the time of the Talmud already, our ability to change our understanding of the Torah has gone down. You guys with me?
Yep.
Since when?
I can't tell you a specific generation. In the Talmud we know it is that way, and in the Mishnah we know it isn't that way. So it seems like that's where the change happened, but I don't know more exact than that. In the time of the Talmud already, they could not. In the time of the Mishnah, they could. Yeah?
If I'm saying that the previous generation knew it better than I did, and I make a statement, how do we know that my statement is good? Is an accurate thought? Like, well, that's it.
Because you're still good.
I'm continuing the tradition. The statements that continued in the Talmud were not derivations. What the Talmud did was the Talmud said, we have a tradition, for example, that these two words, we know somewhere in Tanakh you have to learn kicha kicha. It says the word kach in two places. And we have to derive from that how a man is supposed to take a woman. It says when you marry a woman, when you take a woman to be your wife. So then there are specific laws in the Torah. Well, what does the Torah mean? How do you take halachically a woman to be your wife? So they just said you could give her something of value. How did they derive that? They derived it from the Torah using the law called the Gzeras Shava, the law of logic called the Gzeras Shava. They said it says the word to take a wife. It says that Abraham took the money that he gave the money, and the money was taken when he bought a field. From here we see that you can take a wife with money, with something of value.
This is one of the 13.
That's one of the 13 laws of derivation which they had a tradition on. They could not, in the time of the Talmud, start saying, how do you get married? Let's use the laws of derivation. We'll invent a new application. They said, we cannot do that. We could take the applications we have a tradition on and apply them. But we cannot use new applications. And we cannot answer questions based upon our analysis of the Torah with 12 of the 13 principles. One they said they still could use, the Kal Vachomer. But all the other ones they said we can't use new applications. Yeah.
The codification of the law, like the finalization of it at this point, to the point where they said they could no longer apply any of the rules except for Kal Vachomer, did this coincide also with the redaction of the Ketuvim?
Were they parallel events, or were they related to each other at all?
I don't think so. So we start seeing that at the period of the Talmud, the rabbi's ability, A, to change our understanding of the Torah has gone, B, to answer questions based upon a derivation from the Torah has also gone, aside from if they use a Kal Vachomer. But we no longer can have these drastic changes where the rabbis can say, this is, we derive from the Torah this way. Already in the time of the Talmud, that could not happen. You guys with me till here? Okay. Now we move on. So the rabbis of the Talmud have a tradition on how to understand Torah. Will people here stay more awake if we have air conditioning?
No, I'm going to sleep.
Okay. So the rabbis of the Talmud, they have the tradition of the written law and the tradition of the oral law, and from that they continue and derive the reasons behind the Mishnah. That's what the Talmud is filled with. What are the reasons of the laws in the Mishnah? So that's the Talmud. We reach a point towards the end of the Talmud where our understanding goes down, our tradition goes down. Again we're in exile, again we're being chased. And with the sealing of the Talmud, what basically happened was that our ability to make changes in the oral law went down. And the rabbi said, we see people don't have a tradition on understanding the Mishnah like they did until now. Once upon a time, from the time Moshe Rabbeinu, people had a tradition on the Mishnayot, the oral law, and the understanding of the Mishnayot. Came Rebbe's generation of Yehuda Nasi shortly after the destruction of the Second Temple, and Rebbe said, people are not remembering the oral law well enough, we're writing down the Mishnah, we're limiting the number of opinions that will be halachically acceptable, and from now on that's the base of the oral law. But the reasonings behind the Mishnah, that people still maintain the tradition on. And their application, people maintain the tradition on. Came the time, the period ending of the Talmud, and the rabbi said, people don't have a clear understanding of the oral law. We have to write down one version that will give us the reasonings behind the oral law. And with that, our rabbis wrote down, the Beis Medrash of Ravashi, wrote down the Talmud. They compiled the Talmud. Many people had a Talmud until then. Moshe Rabbeinu had a Talmud. Talmud is the reasoning behind the oral law. And with the compilation of the Talmud, what happened was a codification of Jewish law to an extent, because the Talmud has conclusions. The Talmud has questions, and it says, the halacha is like this, we have rules, Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai, halacha is like Beis Hillel, halacha is like Rebbe against most people, halacha is like Rabbi Akiva against most Tanaim you'll disagree with. The Talmud codifies. The Talmud gives us laws and rules, and we can't change from that. And the Talmud was accepted by the whole Jewish people, and the Jews accepted that we cannot change from the Talmud. And now we've gone down another level. So now, what can we do? Any question we have, we could turn to the Talmud and derive the law from the Talmud. So theoretically, everything should be very simple from here. Nothing could change much. So that's all we'll discuss in a minute. Yeah. First, tell me your name. I don't know your name.
Adam.
Adam, okay.
How's it for people to make laws?
We'll get to that, wait. That's the next step. That we'll get to.
Is there one step?
Ari, yeah.
So, two things. One, so Moshe, now you're saying Moshe probably did not have the same Talmud?
Moshe had a form of Talmud.
It's the one that we have.
A lot of those questions he had, because a lot of it is just
the same answers.
Some of them yes, and some of them no.
Why are we saying that the answers we have are the answers?
Because the rabbis of each generation were given the power to come to a conclusion, and just like Moshe could give a ruling in his court, if we have a tradition that that's his ruling, we won't overturn it. But if we have no tradition what his ruling is, so then when we have to analyze the question, our job, if we are rabbis of that stature, is to come to the conclusion using the laws that Moshe gave us. And when we apply them, we will come to the conclusion that we deem right. And the Torah gives us that power. The Torah says, learn Torah, master it, master the laws of logic, master the laws of the Torah, master the oral law and the tradition, and then you can apply it. Now, each generation with its ability of application. In a second, we'll discuss what's left for rabbis to do nowadays after the Talmud. Why is it that there's machlokas after the Talmud? But in general, our ability today is relegated to the understanding of the Talmud. Whereas in the time of the Talmud, they were given the ability to understand the Torah. In Moshe Rabbeinu's time, Moshe was an exception to an extent because Moshe, whatever he said, he asked God. So he knew what he was talking about. You couldn't really disagree with him. Moshe was the only generation where God says, I'm talking through Moshe. What Moshe says is right. Yeshua, Moshe's disciple, let's say Yeshua says the law is X, and the rabbis disagree with him. So who says the law is going to be with Yeshua? Yeshua says, but I'll ask God. God says, I'm not answering you, Yeshua. There was one man who I told the Torah to. That was Moshe. No one else. And after Moshe, you have to figure it out on your own. Even in Moshe's time, we have a medrash that says that Moshe presented things before his high court, and the high court had to decide, and they would take a vote on it, and they would go by the majority opinion, which seems to indicate that there were things that Moshe didn't come with prophecy. Moshe, God said, figure it out with your court. And then Moshe would discuss it with his court, and sometimes Moshe was won over. That's what it would seem from the Medrash, because the Medrash says that there are things that the courts have to decide. But it isn't clear that it means literally in Moshe's generation. The Medrash says, as we discussed in the Friday class, that there was that God told Moshe the courts will have to decide by majority opinion. Yeah?
So that as the rules of how we how we derive laws from the Talmud, these are in the Talmud, or this is an oral tradition that's kept till later?
Wait, so that's what we're getting to right now. That's what we'll discuss. Yeah?
Sort of a follow-up, which I guess we'll get to later, but it's not in like the Torah, the written Torah, what you had said before about that we're given that you're supposed to derive based on those 13 principles and all that.
That's not so simple. If you want, we could analyze it literally, and what it says literally in the Rambam, and maybe it's even in the Talmud, I don't remember. We have to look and see in the beginning of the Sefra. What it says is that Moshe was given this at Sinai, that this is part of our oral tradition. That's what it says. So if I wanted to answer you black and white, I would tell you, fine, it doesn't say it in the Torah, just like it doesn't say your tefillin have to be black in the Torah. It's part of the tradition we have for Moshe. There are things we have on tradition. But there's a rabbi I learned by in Manzi named Rabbi Avram Pessin. May he have a speedy recovery. He needs a refuge thing. So he wrote a whole compilation showing how all the laws, the Yud Gimel Midos, the laws of logic, of derivation that are in the Torah, are applied in modern law. He showed how in modern law, in constitutional law, in the general law, these are used because these are laws of logic. So we could just say that the Yud Gimel Midos, the Gemara sometimes says, if it's a svara, if you could understand it logically, why does the Torah have to say it to us? So it means the Gemara's approach is that things that are logical, I don't even need the Torah for. It's not that I have the Torah, so what do I need logic? Say, no, if it's logical, if you could figure it out, if it's obvious logically, then I don't need the Torah for that. So if modern law has accepted that it's logical to use these 13 laws of inference, I'm saying, wait. I'm saying, so I could answer you and just tell you they're logical. And refer you to his book, and you could see how he proves how each one of them is logical. And you could also read, there was a Rav Katzenelnbogin Bogin who lived 100 years ago, who wrote a compilation called Halichos Olam. There are two other compilations called Halichos Olam, but Rav Katzenelnbogin Bogin wrote a book called Halichos Olam about the stars and constellations. And over there he has a whole section where he describes how the 13 principles are laws of logic and inference. And he describes how you could infer each one without the Torah, without our tradition for Moshe. So I could just tell you that. But the truth is that in the Torah itself, we do see at least part of the laws of inference. And that, the more you learn, the more you'll see. You'll see that the Torah does tell us. There are things, we have it on tradition for Moshe, it is logical, and it's also in the Torah, but that's a separate question.
So,
I'm just, he asked, the 13 laws of inference, are they in the Torah? Are, are they there? Where are they written? So
the ones that are not, same part. So let's say 12 of them are written, one of them is not. Whatever, 5, 7.
Trying to think if there's really one that's not. I'm not sure there's one that's not. But let's say there's one that's not, yeah?
So, it says in the Talmud that they have these 13 laws.
That we have it on tradition from Moshe Rabbeinu, correct. It's halacha leMoshe miSinai. The Yud Gimel Midos Shator Nidreshes Vem, the 13 laws of inference that we use to derive things from the Torah, are on tradition from Moshe.
But you said that the tradition had been, wasn't as solid the further you got away from.
I said that they themselves recognized that their tradition on how to apply it was not good enough, correct? It's not I that says it, it's a kinnas sofrim on the Rambam. It seems to be the Rambam's understanding in his introduction.
But, so if I am saying that I don't understand at all. I don't understand at all. I just understand what you're saying. I don't understand at all. I just understand these 13 principles. That's all I understand, and let's work from there. Or are you saying that, how do we know? They remembered some of it.
No, they remembered the laws, and they knew how to apply it. But we said that in order to apply it, a person has to have, we said one of the things is a very, very good and accurate tradition on how to apply.
But the tradition wasn't as strong.
Wasn't as strong doesn't mean it wasn't there. It means that they still had the tradition, but they felt by themselves that they didn't have the depth of grasp to be able to apply it as well, and therefore they wouldn't do it.
So you're saying that they remembered all of the laws, they just weren't sure how to apply them?
Remembered all the laws, we know they remembered. They had it written down, and they knew them, for sure. We have them. We say them every morning in Shacharis. We know what they are. We know in general how to apply them. But you understand that in order to derive something from the Torah and make something biblical, you have to have a very, very, very good grasp on all the intricacies and details and depths of understanding to these 13 principles of inference. And anyone that studied law, we could understand it also even if we hadn't studied law, we know that there are going to be minute differences that can make a major difference. And on those minute differences, they felt that they didn't have a strong enough tradition. We know that in order to get a good tradition, you have to study 40 years by a rabbi. The Jewish people were taught at the end of last week's parsha, Moshe said, now you're starting to understand the Torah I've taught you. After 40 years, you guys are starting to understand. From there we derive that it takes 40 years for a person to start understanding the depths of what his rabbi is teaching him. So it's not just a question of knowing this is the law. Every law is going to have a lot of depth as to how to apply it. And you have to know it very, very, very well. Our sages weren't quick to bring a ruling. They analyzed it and thought it and discussed it and fought it over. We've mentioned this example before, that when Rabbi Feinstein was asked, the case of the Siamese twins that were attached, and only one of them would remain alive, and they had to cut between them, and they were sharing certain vital limbs, and it was a matter of time, either they would both die, but one had to live. And the question was, how do you cut them up? Meaning they were sharing the brain, they were sharing part of the kidneys, how do you cut it up? Which side remains alive? How do you decide which one owns the brain, which one owns the kidney? Who runs the show? Who do you go by? So Rabbi Feinstein was asked the question, and it's famous that he went for 2 weeks straight. He went into a room to review the Talmud that applies to this and review the laws, and he said not to be disturbed with any other question. And for 2 weeks straight, he sat down and reviewed it again and again and went through it and wrote up a response to answer this question. At the end of those 2 weeks, he came out of his room and went across the hallway, knocked on the door. He had a neighbor who was a big Talmud Chacham, Rav Tovia Goldstein Zatzal, and he told him, I want to tell you what I thought. Tell me if you agree with me or not. Tell me why I'm wrong. And he sat him down and started reviewing with him after 2 weeks of his coming to his own conclusion, started reviewing with him all the Talmud that he had learned and why he thought this was the correct conclusion, and he wanted to hear what he said. When Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach wanted to disagree with Rav Feinstein on a certain issue in halacha, so he sent the letter to Rabbi Feinstein first. He said, before I publish my disagreement with you, this is what I think and why. Analyze it and tell me if you allow me to publish it. Or do you think I'm totally wrong and tell me why? So the rabbis were very modest people, always. Before they said an opinion, they'd analyze it very, very well. They didn't shoot off the cuff. And then they'd ask their friends, tell me, do you disagree with me? The Talmud records that there were rabbis that before they'd enter court, they'd ask other rabbis, come with me. I don't want to have to judge alone. Why should the sword be hanging only over my head? I want as many people around to tell me if they disagree with me. Like, you guys should all come with me. The rabbis were always very modest. The key to giving a correct ruling is being modest and trying to hear what other people say. They shied away from having to give rulings. And when they had to, so they wanted to be sure they were right. And if they already said something, then they only said it when they were sure they were right.
So,
yeah, I'm with you. As Ari will remind us, it's Thursday night, right?
So there's a big question that seems to come up. And I mean, here we seem to see a change in what many people see Judaism as fundamentalist to a certain extent. I mean, it is fundamentalist to a certain extent. But how much? Because we see that part of that whole, how do you say, Jewish belief is the power of the brain, okay?
So wait, you're getting to apply the halacha today.
To refine something.
So wait, today we haven't yet gotten to today. We're still holding over 1,000 years ago. We're holding by the ceiling of the Talmud. So we'll get to that.
Okay,
wait. Right. We still got a... So what's left? We have the written law, which we can't use our laws of logic to apply and change. That's sealed already from the time of the end of the Mishnah. And we have the oral law, which we have the Mishnah written down. So that's written. We have the Talmud written down. So what's left is a lot.
So you say that if there was a conflict, like a generation of like Russians that were in making a lot, that means they could twist the whole Torah and forever there would be a lot.
You're talking about historically?
Potentially. I don't know if it happens historically, but...
Potentially, things could happen, sure. That's why one of the first things the Rambam does in his introduction to Mishneh Torah is trace the tradition till him. The Rambam traces the tradition till Rav Ashi, basically. He shows how every generation had a high court that was worthwhile, that was big tzaddik and big tamid chacham leading it. He traces the tradition from Moshe Rabbeinu till the ceiling of the Talmud. He shows how there's a direct contact passing from one head of the court to the next head of the court. You could read it. The Rambam says there were 40. There were 40 people from Moshe Rabbeinu till Rav Ashi. So one of the first things the Rambam does in his introduction to his book.
To the Mishneh Torah.
Correct. So the Talmud has been written. And the Talmud gives us reasons. But as we all know, the Talmud has... What? The Talmud has... different understandings and disagreements. The Talmud is filled with disagreements. So now that we have the Torah, the Mishnah, the Talmud, what?
40 generations in 1700 years.
40 is a generation.
Read it.
1600 years.
Guess what? 40 generations at what? How many years?
40 years.
40
years per generation as well.
Each person is one.
Yeah.
We also have a few people there who lived a very, very long time. Read it, you'll see. The Rambam addresses that, and the Rambam's commentaries address that too. Think about it. I learned by rabbis who are 100 years old, 95 years old now. So how many years does that span?
But the person who takes in line next.
Right. He's going to learn from me potentially in 40 years, in 60 years. I don't know
no,
when I'm going to live.
You're the person who is.
Let's say I'm getting a tradition, right? So I learned by rabbis who are 100 years old now. I did. I learned by Rabbi Zev Wein, who just passed away. He was 98, I don't know, maybe 102. He was up there. His son is, Adnav Eslim, is I think in his 80s. I learned by his son also. I learned by Rav Pesant, 120. He's no youngster. I learned by Rabbi Feinstein. He's also Rabbi Avram Shapiro. Here is well over 90 to 120. I don't know if he's past 100, but he's close to it. So think about it. What does that mean? I mean, you don't know my age, but assume I'm 20, right? Okay, so I'm a little over 20, but let's say I'm 20. So you've already covered 80 years. That's not so difficult. Take 40 times that. That's 3,200 years. 1,700 isn't a lot. The Talmud doesn't always give us conclusive answers. The Talmud poses questions and poses sometimes differentiating opinions. And we have a tradition how we're supposed to understand the Talmud. Part of that is built into the Talmud. Part of that Talmud itself tells us. Talmud tells us that when things are written in a plain manner, that means that it's taken for granted. That's not halacha. That's called the stam. Stima, something that's written in a plain manner, that means either the Mishnah or the Gemara is assuming that's the law. From there you could see if in one place in the Talmud discusses should it be A or B, and in another place the Talmud takes for granted that it's A, so you know that the ruling is like A. We know that Yachid v'Rabim al-Hakke Rabim, that we go with the majority opinion, that's in the Talmud. We know that from the generation of Rava onward, we go with the latter opinion. We say the later generation saw everything the previous generation said, and if even so they disagreed with them, so then they must have had a good proof, and the later generation wins. So the Talmud gives us many of the laws, not all, but many of them are written into the Talmud. Yeah.
You said idea of the majority winning. Till what time does it go? For example, you have started machinizing, you have people in different lands.
Wait, that's a detail. Let's get the picture and then we'll deal with details. Fine, we'll get to that. If you want, we'll get to that. Remind me. But, that we'll get to. It, but you have to remind me. That's not planned for this question. It's an adjunct. So, as part of the Talmud, we have laws. And the Talmud tells us how to reach conclusions. But not everything is simple. And sometimes you have two things that disagree. You have one place of disagreement between a majority and a minority opinion, and in another place the Talmud takes for granted like the minority opinion. So which do you go with? Majority against minority wins, or the place where the Talmud takes it for granted wins? Which one wins? And that's where you start seeing the Rishonim, the first people that came after the Talmud, had different traditions and different understandings and different conclusions as to how you should rule. Because not everything is written in the Talmud clearly. A lot of the Talmud gives us reasons and gives us different conflicting understandings as to the reasons. And how do you decide which is right? So that's where you start having the many different opinions among Rishonim. Part of it goes back to tradition, that they had different traditions how to rule. And we see that there were different traditions. The Shammai and Beis Hillel had two opinions. You had in the Gemara different opinions. And part of it is just what they logically thought how the ruling should be. Yeah.
What about the Gaonim?
Gaonim as well. You have different.
But it's not. Doesn't come out as big until the time of the Rishonim, or we.
No, I just meant Rishonim. So all inclusive. Just a second. Yeah.
Can you give us a timeline, like Tanakh, Amorim, Rishonim?
Oh, yeah. Med Shem, I'll photocopy that for you. I have that. I just have to photocopy it. There's a good book on sale now by Feldheim called The Jewish Fact Book. It's a small. It's a big book, but it's very thin. By Mrs. Gentz, I think.
How many shout-outs?
I think it's called The Jewish Fact Book. It's a pink book. It looks like a kid's book. It's written like it's for kids, but I bought two or three copies of it. I have it to lend if you guys want to borrow. I bought copies to be able to lend out, and I bought a copy for the library here. So I mentioned soon you'll have it in the library. But you guys could buy it if you want to go. It's like 15 shekel. And ordinarily it's 50 or 60 shekel. What? On sale at Feldheim now, it's 15 shekel.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's
they ran out of it? Okay. So now we're going to address another aspect of this question, and this is going to bring us to today. And that is the difference between Rishonim and Achonim. We say that around the end of the 1400s, there was a change. And at that point starts the period of the Achonim. That we say everyone after that is called an Acharon, till today. Those are the last people. Everyone before about 1500 was a Rishon.
So the Rishon period was turned by what? What kind of situation brought in the Rishon?
So we say there was the Gemara, and then the Gaonim, Rabbanan Savarai, that was a generation that still edited the Gemara. The Gemara ended with Ravina and Ravashi. Ravina is, it seems, a slightly later generation than Ravashi. They overlap. And then we have the Rabban Sobrai, those are rabbis that edited the Talmud. And then we have the Gaonim period. And the Gaonim were much greater than the Rishonim. In order for a person to become a Gaon, he would have to be tested on the whole Talmud by heart in order to get stature of Gaon. That was just for starters. You have to be able to say the whole Talmud by heart.
Quote
it. Quote the whole Talmud by heart.
They wouldn't ask you a question, they'd actually ask you to.
First quote it, then they'll ask you questions. Saying that the, in order to enter the test, the first thing Gaon had to get was tested on the whole Talmud by heart. And then we have the period of the Rishonim. Yes? Yeah, okay, that doesn't say the Gaonim had to be tested on that. I've heard stories. I don't know. The...
On the first page of my book.
We have Tanoim, the Tanoic period, Amoraim, Rabban and Savaroi, those are the rabbis who edited the Talmud, the Gaonim, the Gaonic period. Sure. I'll photocopy for you with timelines. Rabbanan Savorai. If you want to, write it on the board.
I don't have
a
board.
No, it'll take longer on the board. If you own him, you show him. And then, after the late 1400s, we enter the period that lasts till today, called the Achronim. What changed? Same thing as the time of the Gemara. What changed is that the rabbis realized we're not as great as our predecessors. We can no longer disagree with them. So, the Rishonim, you have the Rambam. The Rambam rules one way. The Rambam rules that if one thinks a bracha without mouthing it out, without moving his lips, that's good enough. Worst comes to worst. We don't rule that way. Many people disagree with the Rambam. Many Rishonim. So according to the Rambam, it would seem to also be a bracha levatala, yeah. If one thinks a bracha, we rule that you have to at least mouth it with your lips. That's the Tosfos opinion. It's the Rosh. The Rishonim who disagree with the Rambam, they say you have to move your lips at least. If you just throw it in your head, that's nothing. At least you have to move your lips. If you moved your lips, but you didn't hear your own voice, so worst comes to worst, that's a good bracha. Ideally, you have to hear it. So that's why people sometimes, they say benching, they say Birkat HaMazon, they don't hear it. If you don't hear it, that's not benching. You have to at least hear it with your own ears. Worst comes to worst, you're Yotze if you moved your lips. But ideally, one should mouth it. So we have two opinions. We have the Rambam, and we have the Tosfos. And so we have many, many disagreements in the understanding of the Talmud. Talmud says there's room to understand this way and that way in the Talmud, to understand what the Talmud's conclusion is. So, can I come up today and say, I have a third opinion, I want to say differently? So the rabbis in the late 1400s, the beginning of the 1500s, they recognized that they don't have a grasp and a tradition in understanding the Talmud like all their predecessors did. They felt like they went down a notch. And they said, we can no longer disagree with our predecessors. We are no longer on their level. Even if we learn Talmud all day and all night, we don't have rabbis to teach us like they had rabbis to teach us. They recognized that their grasp on the Talmud went down. Notice, gentlemen, the modesty here, the honesty here, that the rabbis who are learning day and night, and what they want most, everyone wants to get published, right? Everyone wants to leave his mark on Judaism. You think just because someone's a rabbi, he doesn't have that urge, that want? Even on Moshe and Aaron, the Torah stresses they did exactly what God told them. Says Rashi on the spot, means they didn't even change a little, because everyone wants to change a little. Everyone wants to put their mark on life, on Judaism. But the rabbis were honest, and they were modest. And therefore, when the truth said, you're not on his level, they recognized it. So when Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach in our generation wanted to argue on Rabbi Feinstein, he said, I know he's greater than me. I'm going to ask him for permission before I publish my disagreement with him. Yeah?
Was there anything specific that happened, or they just said, like,
that's a question of opinion. Okay. We find, for example, in our understanding why there was a difference between Beis Hillel, Hillel's disciples, and the predecessors. So the Rambam writes that it's a spiritual thing, that God makes every generation go down a little bit, and Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai were big tzaddikim just like their predecessors. But because God makes every generation goes down, so spiritually, as much as they tried, they could never attain the level of their predecessors. That's what the Rambam writes. And Rav Shri Raigon doesn't go that route. He says they went down a level because nature caused it. They were being chased. There was being rebellion, and we were being attacked by the Romans, and the kings didn't allow for yeshivas to run. So because of all the political turmoil, there were no running yeshivas, and practically they couldn't learn. It seems like Rav Shri Raigon doesn't go the route of the Rambam, saying that spiritually it had to be. So the same thing Rishonim and Achronim. Is it something that has to do with the tradition? Is it a practical thing or is it a spiritual thing? I don't know. Maybe it's both.
Who were the last of the Rishonim? We know we have the big Rishonim.
Everyone that preceded
the start of the Achronim.
The last Rishonim were the period after the Rush. The Rush was among the last. The Rush, his disciples, there you have towards, that's basically the end. That's
well, wasn't Yosef Caro, who was like the last from Spain also, let's say.
Rav Yosef Caro is at the border. It's unclear whether he's a Rishon or an Achron. And I see that we're starting to lose people, so I think we'll stop this topic. The question is, should we...
That's
huh?
No, it's very interesting. Very interesting.
Yeah.
But the ramifications of what you're saying.
We haven't yet gotten to the ramifications. We haven't gotten to present day. But that we're doing in our halacha class, so I don't mind.
But why did every generation fall downwards on the spirit, on the level of spirituality?
Oh, so let's analyze that. Let's make the question a little bit stronger. We find that in science, the world keeps advancing. You have today what you didn't have 5 years ago, or you didn't have 2 years ago. You know that today when they abstract a tumor from someone, part of the procedure in the United States is that they freeze it for 7 years. Because they say science is advancing at such a pace that in 7 years from now, they're going to know so much more than they know today. They have such confidence in the advance of science that they say, maybe there'll be treatment that we don't have today. And if this person is around, we can help them. So they freeze the tumor for 7 years. It's part of the process. Science is advancing at such a pace that doctors have to keep reading the medical literature if they want to remain up to date, because science is advancing. And this is true not only in medicine, this is true in all the sciences.
This cancer thing, breast cancer, they found some. They're saying very similar situations when they're going to reach in like 2 years time.
They're advancing.
Like the most cool, yeah.
They're advancing. So the world seems to be advancing. We find in every realm the world is advancing. When it comes to Torah, we just described how we're on a constant decline. Every generation knows less than the previous generation.
The two, they work in sync, right? The more physical the world, the more we become physically involved in the world, the more we release this physical potential, the more...
You're dealing with spirituality. I'm trying to understand on a simple level.
But that's the Torah, that's the essence of the Torah, is the revelation of the spiritual through the physical. So the deeper we bury ourselves into the physical, the harder it is for us to see the spiritual.
This kind of inferior kind of status, how far do we go with it? So in actual practice, perhaps you should see where you are now as this is what God wants you to be.
That's a different question. Wait, we haven't even begun understanding where we are now. You're going to the offshoots of it. The basic answer is when it came to the Torah, so we got everything. Let's start with science. Man is created. He sees the sunset. He thinks, oh, the sun was turned off. It's because I sinned, so there's no sun in the world. The next day, he sees the sun rise. He recognizes, this is nature. The sun rises, sun sets. So man begins with knowing nothing about nature. And with time, he conquers nature. He gains more and more and more and more understanding. Every year that goes by, man understands nature more. So we've reached a generation where our understanding is exponential as we proceed in the years. Why? Because we started with nothing, and every generation builds upon the previous generation. We can advance. If I start from nothing and I'm analyzing the world, so the more every generation passes on what it knows to the next generation, and the next generation can build on that. When it comes to Torah, we have a situation where we knew everything. Hashem gave Moshe the full Torah, everything, all the deep understandings, every question you have to have, we knew everything. And every generation is trying to work back to what we had previously. We're not trying to invent a new Torah. We're trying to regain that complete understanding of the Torah that Moshe had. How do we do that? We have to get the full tradition. So in the Torah, obviously every generation, I have to count on what my father tells me, which his father told him, which his father told him. So it's very understandable that every generation goes down. Because when you start with having everything, which is very complex and very in-depth, and that has to be passed down, so then every generation loses a little bit. We're not talking about spiritual yet. We're talking about just practical. Practically, it has to be that every generation is going to lose. Spiritually, so we say that that's how God created the world. That every generation goes down a notch.
How far is information lost nowadays?
To tell you a lot of things that halacha gets lost. You read the Rishonim, for example. Some of the Rishonim, you have that quote that they have a tradition. Something that doesn't appear in the Talmud. Isn't written anywhere in the Mishnah, in the Talmud, not written anywhere. And yet we have recordings from Rishonim that they write, we have such a tradition that in Hillel's courtroom, Hillel was 100 years before the destruction of the Second Temple. You're talking about 500-600 years before then. Before the Talmud, the Rishonim write that they have a tradition going back 500 years that in Hillel's courtroom, the following case came up, and this is how he ruled. Something that doesn't appear in the Talmud. We have such examples. So you're asking me how much we lose with each generation? I don't have any tradition that goes back to Hillel. I have what it says in the Talmud, what it says in the Rishonim, but I don't have any tradition from my rabbis that goes back to Hillel. But 1,000 years ago they did.
So it's much easier to transmit information than understand. I was looking at a paper with a friend of mine and talked about prayer, and we were learning from someone. He was talking about how someone praying should be like a man with a carriage pulling a horse. And so the Rav was talking about the way the man controls a horse. And my friend was like, no, I've ridden a carriage with a horse. You're not a carriage with a horse, you walk back and forth. What he's talking about is about shackling. We lose so much. It's one thing, Baruch Hashem, we're in an age now of nearly perfect transmission of information, but understanding is more elusive than ever.
So let's expand on what Yoshua is saying a little bit more. Our sages say that part of passing on the tradition is not only hearing a rabbi, but seeing him. The expression that a rabbi has when he teaches you something, the Gemara says there was a difference between two Tanoim. And one Tana says, you know why I'm so great? Because I saw Rebbe from behind. When Rebbe used to give his class, I would sit behind him. And if I would have been in front, you know where I would be, where I could be today. And that is because part of the tradition is also a face. I have a tradition, for example, from Rabbi Pessin, that he has a tradition that goes back about 150 years, that there was once a Shabbos table where the Brisker Rav was sitting, and he was sitting with a disciple. And the women were singing smears. So his disciple turns, he says, shh, wanted to quiet down the women. And the Brisker Rav made a face at him. Why are you doing it? I have a tradition on that face that goes from Rav Pessin back to the Brisker Rav. So what does that face mean? So Rav Pessin expanded on that face. Rav Pessin told me that in Halacha there is a concept of, you find in the Gemara, that mochin, someone does something, you tell him that's wrong, don't do that. And there's a concept in mochin that if he does it, you don't say anything, even though he shouldn't really be doing it. And then there's a concept, there's an in-between, that's called you're not moche, and you're even moche biada moche. That if someone tries to reprimand someone else for doing it, you make a face, even though really that other person shouldn't be doing it. It's like a notch in between. It's not bad enough that you should say something. And if someone does say something, you tell her, you make a face at him. You understand the level of tradition? I don't have a tradition that goes back to Rebbe, what kind of face he made. I have a tradition on certain answers that the Brisker Rav gave. But that's because I learned by a rabbi, I learned by his father-in-law, I learned by a rabbi, I learned by the Brisker Rav. So I have some kind of tradition. Right. That's what we're trying to illustrate, that the Tana who learned behind Rebbe could not see his face. The Gemara sometimes says, Shosik Rav. Rav was asked the question and he was silent. So why does the Gemara tell us he was silent? So some explain that he was silent, but he made a face. Now what was that face saying? I approve or I disapprove? So that there's a discussion. So when we talk about tradition, tradition isn't only a question of yes, no. It's a question of nuances. It's a question of behavior. It's a question of how the person is. And to get that tradition, so you have to see the Rebbe. You have to have a Rebbe who saw his Rebbe. And obviously, as the tradition goes on, you lose some of that.
I still don't understand something about this.
That's great. If you don't understand only one thing, you're ahead of me. Yeah, I'm with you.
Because, as you said, man is able to interpret something a certain way. He's given the power of logic, okay? And that in itself becomes intrinsically halacha. It becomes something holy. So, okay, you've got information. Now the understanding is saying, okay, you can pass information on, but you don't pass understanding on. So if it's up to our generation to do this kind of process of understanding, what is the problem in that situation? If they've got that information and they derive from it. So in itself, it's not that you're going a level down. It's you apply it to your situation. It's that ideal of the role of
Christ. So we'll get to that. Not yet. The question is, should we continue on this point or do part two 2 weeks down the road or in Friday's class?
Is this point building? Are
we
showing up?
We haven't yet gotten to practical today. Okay. The main question we haven't addressed. The question was, how does halacha change today? How much can halacha change today? So we've understood what halacha once upon a time could change, and we've understood how with each generation we could change less and less and less. But we don't yet understand what could we do? What's left in our hands? Are you coming for Shabbos? The Shabbaton in Hebron?
No.
Okay.
You can't. Now,
yeah, it's Shabbaton in Hebron.
Right.
You didn't know about it.
Yeah.
Chavan. Okay. Do you want to join? Maybe we can still do something about it.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, sure.
I'm tired. Am I going to be happy with it?
Huh? How many people want to continue on this now?
As opposed to what?
It's supposed to go on. There are other questions, Mishlei, Tehillim,
and continue
and do this
question.
In 2 weeks we'll continue from where we stopped here, or tomorrow.
I think we have decided. I don't know. Perhaps should we?
I see people's focus is going.
I prefer to go forward.
But it's your forward.